Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. It's a full house in the studio today because the entire Cherry Bomb team is super excited about today's guest. We have Ali Mish here. We have Donna Yen, both back in the studio, our editorial assistants. Thanks, guys. I'm glad you're here.
We're so excited.
Donna's not saying anything. Donna's so excited, she can't say anything.
I can't speak.
But you guys are going to have to chime in with some questions later because we talk a lot about this guest. We talk a lot about you behind your back, but it's all good stuff.
We have a quota about hitting Samin talk and Anthony Bourdain
yes.
talk.
If we don't talk about you at least twice a day, it's a bad day at Cherry Bomb headquarters. Today's show, everybody, is sponsored by Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school with locations around the globe. Be sure to check out our sweepstakes with Le Cordon Bleu. You could win culinary classes in Paris, London, or Ottawa, plus airfare from New York, hotel, and a little spending money. Just visit cherrybomb.com to enter. The contest will be over in a few weeks, so your time is running out. Do not delay. And Castor and Pollux, makers of the brand new purposeful pet food line, Pristine. A lot of Bomb Squad members are proud pet parents, so you'll want to know about this responsibly sourced and grain-free line. Visit purposefulpetfood.com for more. Okay, we really are super thrilled about today's guest. It's Samin Nosrat, author of the hottest cookbook of the year, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. Samin started in this industry by vacuuming floors at Chez Panisse 17 years ago and has, in record time, become one of the most beloved personalities in the food world. Her cookbook is 470 pages, bigger than a Bible, and does not contain a single photo, making it a very unlikely bestseller. Samin and Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat are overnight sensations, almost decades in the making. We are thrilled to have this life force of a human being in the studio. Samin Nosrat, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you for having me. That was a really nice... Now I'm about to cry. That was a really nice introduction.
And you know what? We left out the best part. Last week's guest, who came with me to your book signing at the 92nd Street Y, said that she tells everyone you are the next Julia Child.
That's amazing.
It doesn't get better than... We could just end there. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I mean, it doesn't get better than there than that. You are one busy babe.
I'm so tired, you guys.
I know you're not sitting around saying, I'm the next Julia Child. Snap.
It is really bananas for people to say that about you. I haven't actually let that sink in what it means. Like, I kind of... It's better to not think about it.
Yeah, exactly. But I feel bad now for Julia Child because nobody... What'd they say to her? They couldn't say you're the next Julia Child.
She's pretty much forever, preserved.
She was fine, despite that. In all seriousness, we're super thrilled that you took the time to come here because we do know how busy you are. You had a killer book signing. We're taping this. You'll hear everybody out there will hear this a week after we tape it. But you had a fantastic book signing last night at Books Are Magic, Emma Straub's magical bookstore Cobble Hill, and it was packed.
It was like a sardine tin.
Were you like schwitzing up there?
I was schwitzing all day. Yeah. But it was for sure. It was amazing. I mean, my cousin came later and he sent me a picture from the street because there were people on the street who couldn't fit inside. It's really, you know, people keep asking, like, what's the most overwhelming or amazing part of this? I just can't believe people care. And like, you obviously have all these hopes and dreams, you know, and I worked on this for so long. I had a lot of time to visualize and dream and think of what I wanted for it. But I also went to a lot of therapy and tried really hard to manage my expectations and you know, define success on my own terms and not on how the world would receive it. So it still is really bananas that anyone care. Like, it's really crazy.
I know. Can I ask a really shallow question?
Of course.
We're all obsessed with your collection of Mexican dresses.
Oh, yes. Although that was the same one.
Was it the same one? Yeah, I was trying to figure out, does she just have the world's best collection of these Mexican dresses?
I have that one that I love and I wear a lot. And then my friend Mara is breastfeeding now. And so she lent me her like amazing one that she has. So I have like three that I sort of rotate. And then yesterday I went to the store on Atlantic Avenue, Meg. And I walked in, I was wearing that one. And they're like, did you buy it here? Because they had a whole bunch of them.
And did you shop?
I bought a dress that has flowers and fruit on it, like a flowers and fruit print, which was perfect because I love flowers and fruit. So, yeah.
I'm sure we'll be seeing that at a future
yeah, it'll be in all the future events.
Book signing or reading. So, we have so many questions. I really don't even know where to start. So, let's just start at the beginning. So, tell us about your family and what their approach to food was like.
So, my family's from Iran, and my parents came to San Diego in, I think, 1976. I was born in 1979. And my mom, it was always her, you know, vision and goal to really immerse me and my brothers in our culture. And the primary way to do that was through the food. And so she really took pride in finding the best tasting ingredients. And a lot of that involved a lot of driving around Southern California. So I always joke that 40% of my childhood was spent in the back of the station wagon. Like, so sometimes we would drive to Irvine. There's this huge grocery store there, like a big, it's the size of a full grocery store, but it's all Iranian food. And there's a bakery on the side of it, and there's a limit, like 2 per person limit of this bread, this sangak bread that they're making. And so my mom would bring us all, and we would all get out, and she'd be like, each person has to get 2 so that we can take 10 home, you know?
Like, sounds like an early version of tartine in San Francisco. Totally.
It is kind of like that.
Or like a Chanel shop where they're like, you can only buy 2 of those handbags.
Yeah, so driving 80 miles for some bread was like not out of the question. And
can I ask a question? Because my mom had a station wagon, and I'm 10 years older than you, but I think that was back in the time where there weren't quite as many safety regulations, and you would be, did you sit in the way back of the station wagon?
Ours didn't have the way back, but I was jealous of friends who had the way back. And then when that movie, The Way Back, came out, I was so stoked because I was like, oh yeah. And I was always jealous of the people who could sit facing back. And
right. So for those of you who have no idea what the hell we're talking about, there were big station wagons and kids didn't have to be belted in. I think drivers probably had to wear seatbelts, but nobody else had to. And you would actually put the kids in the back of the station wagon facing the oncoming traffic with no seatbelts.
It was crazy.
And I lived to tell the tale.
Oh my God.
Yes.
And then some of them started making it with seats in the very back facing the oncoming traffic, but no seatbelt, nothing. So,
yes. Yeah, crazy childhood. So mom was driving around. Mom obviously loved to cook.
She's an amazing cook. And, you know, even now that I know what extraordinary cooking is, I still think my mom's a pretty amazing cook. And
when did you first help her in the kitchen?
She was not really, I was not a big helper, and or she wasn't really after that from us. But Iranian cooking is really, really labor intensive and time consuming. So mostly because it's mostly herbs and vegetable prep is, this is something I feel like I need to write a thing about, but vegetables are the most labor intensive part of cooking. And that's why I find vegetable intensive cuisine to be the most luxurious. Like when I go to Chez Panisse and you get like artichokes and asparagus and fava beans in the spring, you're like, you just look at it, you're like, that was a lot of work. And all the peas that were shelled, you know, how many hands had to touch this? So we had to help with things like shelling fava beans and, you know, peeling eggplant, but we weren't in the kitchen. I wasn't learning a lot. It just, to me, all of my attention went to the eating part, not the cooking part.
And how many siblings?
I have 2 brothers. They're twins, so they're 4 years younger than me.
Oh, wow. So you're the oldest?
I'm the oldest, yeah.
Okay. And did you always have, you just have a great personality. Were you always, do you consider yourself an extrovert?
I always had, and I've always tested ENFP. But in the past,
tell people what that means.
Which is the, on the Myers-Briggs, like personality test. I don't know what all the things stand for, but it's like, extroverted, I'm a feeler, I'm a intuitive, and I'm a, I think P is perceptive rather than judging. Over the past 20 years I've taken that test. I take it every few years. I'll be like, maybe I'm something new now, but nope, I'm always ENFP. But I think I'm on the borderline, and I, especially because I spend so much energy outside and I love giving what I have to people, when I'm by myself, I really like go home and I'm on the couch, you know, drinking cold soup. Yeah. Not talking to anyone. Yeah.
So you go to high school. What happened after high school?
I went to high school. I had an incredible English teacher who really was... I went into high school thinking I would be an orthopedic surgeon, a doctor, because Iranian children are supposed to be grow up to be engineers, lawyers, or doctors. And I had this English teacher in 11th grade, Mr. Dorman, who he also was our cross-country coach. He was the first feminist I ever met. He empowered us as like young women. He took us camping and taught us the word badass. He, you know, he taught us to be fearless. And he also was my English teacher. He gave me my first subscription to the New Yorker. We journaled in our class. He taught me to love poetry and he told me I could write. And so by the time he was done with me, I was like, okay, I'm going to be an English major. So, which I'm sure really displeased all my parents, but, and everyone else in my family. But so I went to Berkeley and I was an English major. I knew that. And I started taking poetry classes. And my sophomore year, I had this incredible poetry class with the poet Robert Haas. And there was this beautiful boy in the class.
So many stories start. Rosy cheeks. Yeah. So many stories start that way.
And he stood, and then he stood up, you know, and he gave some impassioned, I don't know, whatever about some poem that I loved. And I was like, I'm in love. And we had to have these, like study groups, you know, but Robert directed us to have these study groups that we would meet after like on evenings in different people's homes. So I like, of course, maneuvered my way into Johnny's group. And then like shortly after that professed my love and took a while, but he eventually reciprocated, and he was from San Francisco, and he always wanted to eat at Chez Panisse, which I had not really, like, I wasn't really aware of it. I didn't really know what it was. And a big way of how Johnny and I spent our time was him showing me, you know, like, this is the place I grew up going to have ice cream, Mitchell's. It's this incredible ice cream shop in the Mission in San Francisco where
I love Mitchell's.
It's so good. And all of these different cultures, you know, they really serve all of these different cultures. So there's all these different tropical fruit flavors and avocado and ube.
Ube is my favorite. Yeah.
And young coconut. My favorite's macapuno, the young coconut. I love that one.
Get ube and the coconut
together. Yeah, it's so good. And, you know, and Golden Boy Pizza, which is like this funny little punk pizzeria in North Beach with square slices. And I remember he was really into brie. Like, I had never had brie before. And so we would go, we felt really fancy, like we would go buy brie, and then we discovered that you could get double cream brie or triple cream. That felt really fancy. So he wanted to go to Chez Panisse, so we saved our money for 7 months, and we went to Chez Panisse, and that was really my first experience in fine dining, and it was really, I don't know, really imprinted itself on me, and I knew I wanted to work there pretty much immediately. We had friends who were bussers there, so I was like, I want to do this too. I always worked in college, so I wrote a letter.
Did you ever work in food service?
I had never worked in a restaurant. Yeah, I was doing work study. Like, I had only had the most boring jobs. And so I wrote this letter to Alice Waters, you know, and I brought it into the restaurant. They directed me.
Do you remember what you said? Was it particularly English majory? Yeah,
totally.
Poetic?
It was like, yeah, for sure. I was like, I had the most enchanting, inspiring meal. Like, I am, you know, and please give me a chance, even though I've never worked in a restaurant. And I'm skipping over a little part of the dinner that we had that was so inspiring, which was that, you know, the food was amazing. It was really good. I had halibut for the first time. I was really nervous because the only fish I'd ever had before that was salmon and tuna. And so I was like, what's this going to be like? It was totally good. And I had chanterelle mushrooms and guinea hen. And the dessert was chocolate souffle. And when they brought it, the server said, oh, would you like me to show you how to eat it? Have you ever had chocolate souffle before? I said, no, please show me. And she said, okay, well, you poke a hole in it with your spoon and you pour in the sauce. And that way every bite has some sauce in it. So I did that. And she said, how is it? And I said, oh, you know, it's good. I was like, but it would be really a lot better if I had a glass of cold milk. So I had no idea how rude that was to suggest, you know, like how to make something better in the restaurant to the people who made it. And also I had no idea that it's totally considered very childish and kind of gross to have milk after 10 a.m. in the fine dining world. And so she kind of laughed and she brought me milk and she brought us glasses of dessert wine. And, you know, that was my introduction to fine dining. And so when I brought the letter and my resume to Chez Panisse, they directed me over to the floor manager you know, I had to go through this like thing, go into the office, and they brought me to her. And when the door opened, it was the souffle lady. And so she recognized me and I recognized her. And she, I think also, you know, as charming as I may have been, she was probably very desperate because she was like, can you start tomorrow? And so as happens in restaurants. And so I started the next day and my first task was vacuuming the floors.
When did you get to meet Alice?
At that time, it took a while. I think Alice was traveling. I started working in August, and Alice travels a lot in the summer and the fall. Usually she's in Europe. So I don't remember her being around. It took a few months for her to be around. And I don't know if they still do this, but at that time, we used to have to take this quiz. They'd give us this quiz when we got hired, and they'd give us like 3 weeks to fill it out. And it just meant doing investigation and asking questions. And so we'd go, they'd be like, who are the chefs? What are the roles? Like, what's this dish? What's the way to serve the butter? What's the significance of this tree? And what's the significance of the wisteria? And you would fill out your quiz, you'd turn it in, and then Alice would give you a tour. Alice gave everyone a tour. So I did eventually, and you had to take the tour with Alice. So that was within the first 6 months you always knew when Alice was around, and I'm sure this is still true because then everyone's like whispering, like, she's here, she's here.
Did you fangirl hard, or is it different when you work there?
It was such a different time. There was not celebrity chef culture. So even though I worked there and I was certainly aware of her, like, she was my boss. You know, she was the boss. I remember feeling like I wanted her to know who I was and I wanted her to notice me. But I was a busser. There were over 100 employees there. You know, it's a lot of people.
And it took you 20 years, but mission accomplished.
Yeah, totally. It took a really long time, but we got there.
Now she knows. Now everybody knows who you are. So you beg the kitchen for a job.
Yeah, it's so enchanting in there, so special. And I wanted to be part of that. And so it's two restaurants in one. And there is, in some ways, there's not that much division. Like, the kitchen's just filled with cooks. And so I sort of asked all the chefs until one of them was like mildly amenable. And that was Chris Lee. And he,
mildly amenable. Yeah. I need to remember that.
And he gave me a list. He said, you know, like, I want to help you, but I can't give you an internship because you don't know anything. And so, you know, I can't in good conscience like do that. So you need to do some work on your own before you come to me. So he gave me this really long list of cookbooks. He told me how to watch the kitchen when I was bussing tables and what to pay attention to when I was tasting. And he said, go home, like, read these books, cook every day, pay attention, and come back to me, you know, in 6 months or a year. And so I did. And I don't think he expected me to. Like, I don't think anyone, it was crazy what they were asking me to do. It was like self-education. And so, but I did it and I came back, and then they like had to patch together this funny internship for me. It's normally you come for 3 months and you're either in the pastry or the cafe or the downstairs. And so they were sort of still like begrudgingly letting me in. So, so I had 3 days downstairs with Chris. I had 1 day in the cafe and 1 day in pastry, which ended up being this incredible cross training. So I got to know a little bit about everything, which was cool. And then after that, they hired me in the cafe.
How did you come to master the fundamentals to the extent that you've now got 470 pages
of basics?
Yeah.
It's really funny. The whole time I was like, this book is going to be so simple, so short, and the message is so tidy and small, and then I have to present it in this huge book.
Well, you know what? Let's jump ahead for a second, though, because we do need to talk about the message. You said the message is so tidy and small. And genius. I think that's what resonates so much with this book. The title, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, is literal. Mm-hmm. It is the four keys to a great dish.
Yeah, to me, I mean, that was what I learned there, because the menu at Chez Panisse changes every day. So, and I will say, as much as they discourage culinary school, and I pretty much discourage people from going to culinary school, there is a very deeply built respect for tradition and the motherland, you know, which speaks to sort of like the Mediterranean for Chez Panisse. And that is built into all of the cooking there. And so no matter where we were cooking the food from, whether it was like any of the, it took me a while and I started to realize like, oh, last week we made bouillabaisse, this week we're making cacio. Those are two different names for the same thing, and they're different parts of the Mediterranean coast. So the like spices are slightly different, but everything else is the same. Or I remember I had this like you know, so many small light bulb moments that, like, pesto and pea stew are the same thing. That aioli, alioli, and aioli, you know, in the three countries, like Spain, Italy, and France, they're the same thing. And you realize these people, you know, thousands of years ago were the same people, and that these country lines are arbitrary. It's the geography of the place that determines the cuisine more than anything else. And so seeing that and learning that and absolutely all the reading and the travel that they told me to do and the listening to their stories was really what showed me that food, good food around the world is more similar than it is more different. And over time, I started to see that we were always doing the same things, no matter what we were cooking. And we were always paying, you know, there's sort of this trinity, like cooks are always like salt, fat, acid, salt, fat, acid, salt, fat, acid. And that's what you're tasting for. That's what you're making sure that textures are balanced. So that was like, I kind of took that from Tasters, really, is where I got it. And Tasters were these moments before service where we would make one of each dish and everyone would gather around and taste it and talk about it. And at first I was so young and inexperienced, I felt like I had zero authority to ever speak up. So I would always try to anticipate what they would say. And eventually over time I started noticing like, oh, I know what they're going to say. They're going to say this needs more acid, or they're going to say this needs more salt. So I started to, that was really how I developed my palate, was just very thoughtful tasting. And then heat was really, I think heat for me was the scariest. Because I had only ever cooked from recipes before, which are so, clear and precise about the temperature something should be and how many minutes something should cook for. And that was not what was happening. That was not being reflected in that kitchen at all. And I remember one time they sent me upstairs. There was a room in the downstairs ovens. And so they were like, oh, just go cook those in the wood oven. And I was like, what? You know, there's no dial. I can't, how do I measure this thing? And how do I know it's done? And they're like, you just stand there and watch it. That's how you know? And so over time I started to see that, oh, it didn't matter, you know, what we were cooking. It mattered how it was responding to the heat. Another big one was we always made braises. Almost every day there's a braise. And no one ever said to me, the thing I'm looking for is bring it up to a boil, turn it down to a simmer. It was always like, put it in at high, turn it down to low after 30 minutes. It was sort of this vague explanation. So I got used to doing it that way. And one day we made something really good and I wanted to go home and make it. But at home, in the restaurant, we always made it in the ovens because it was big, big batches. And so I was like, oh, it's really hot. I don't really want to turn my oven on. And another cook was like, you can do this on the stovetop. You know that, right? And I had no idea that I could just bring it to a boil and turn it down to a simmer on the stovetop. So I don't know.
You touch on something, and you talked about this last night at the book signing, that we don't trust our senses enough. Mm-hmm. And when we have our cookbook coming out this fall, and our intern Byrne, who helped with a lot of the recipe testing, was there last night. So I loved when you were talking about just knowing something is done based on sound or based on smell. And there were so many times when we were in my apartment testing things, and I would say, Byrne, that sounds like it's done. And she's like, what? And I said, yeah, it sounds like it's done. Or another time, it's like, you could all of a sudden, like, the whole room would fill with the smell of something. And I'm like, Byrne, I think that's done. And I didn't even really realize that I was using my senses
that way.
You so often just think about your eyes and your sense of taste.
Totally. I mean, and we all, you know, one of my favorite sound stories is there's this great pastry chef. She was at Chez Panisse, and now she has this wonderful ice cream shop in Berkeley. Her name is Mary Canales. And
what's her
shop's called EC Ice Cream. It's so good. And my friend was an intern for her in the ice cream shop for a long time. And I remember one day he came to me and he said, it's the craziest thing. Mary can be across the shop in the office and she'll be spinning ice cream and she'll hear when it's done because of the tone of the ice cream thing changes and the reason the tone is changing is because it's thickened so much that it sort of deepens. But that she's so attuned to it, which is so crazy because anytime I've made ice cream in a restaurant, like, you are taught to fear 5 seconds of spinning it too long. So the fact that she was so confident in it and so attuned to it that she could just be over there while this thing is happening, you know, that was so amazing to me. And but I think it comes with practice, and it doesn't have to be something that, you know, like, even, I don't know, this is really bad, cheesy thing, but when I was doing yoga, I used to do a lot of yoga, and they would be, and there's all these things you have to pay attention to, like, you know, tuck your tailbone, do all this stuff. And I remember being so sort of step by step about it. And the yoga teacher, I was like, how do you even do this? And she's like, oh, eventually just become second nature. And I think it's like that. You don't have to think about everything forever. At some point when you're tuned in, you'll hear it. And yeah, the senses are so important. And those are our clues and our cues. And that's how people cooked before.com.
So it's like a sense of flow. They talk about that in yoga, right?
Totally.
So it's flow in the kitchen.
Totally.
It's a joke. Not worth explaining. So, okay, salt, fat, acid, heat. You've got these four elements. When did it click in your brain that, oh, these four things are a theory, and I just kind of came up with a theory?
Yeah, that was right then, like probably about a year after I started cooking, I realized that I understood that it was at the heart of everything we were cooking. And so I remember where I was in the kitchen, and I went to Chrisley and I said, I figured something out. It's salt, fat, acid, heat. Like, that's at the heart of what we're doing here. And I felt so brilliant because it wasn't in any of the books that he had told me to read. No one there had told me about this. And he just looked at me and he was like, yeah, we know. Duh. We all know that. All good cooks know that. That's what we all use. And I really felt, it was funny, but I also felt betrayed, because if they all knew that, how come no one had ever told me? And if no one had told me, maybe no one had ever told people. So I don't know if I had graduated from school yet or not, but, you know, I was probably 21, and I knew I wanted to write it. I got out a legal pad. I still have it, where I like marked everything down. And I was like, I'm going to write this book. It's going to be 12 pages long. It's so simple once you know this thing. And then I realized I didn't know anything about cooking or writing. So I kept doing it, and it just became my system that I filed everything I learned into. And then, you know, even before I got to a point where I could fully articulate it as a teacher to other cooks, it was still what I was teaching people. And then eventually I was forced to really articulate it when I started working with Michael Pollan.
So maybe, I don't know, decades from now, centuries from now, when they're cooking, it's going to be like the E equals MC squared of
kitchens, that would be amazing.
Kitchens, right?
It's, you know, what's interesting is the publishers really went, they did not like the name of the book. And even my publisher, deep into the publishing process, was trying to get me to change the name. And they're like, it just doesn't mean anything. You know, it seems so technical and clinical. And I was like, it doesn't mean anything yet. Like, it's gonna mean something to everyone soon. So just believe in me. And I'm really glad I stuck my guns on that one. Cause, I do think it's a thing. It's the mantra. And if you know that you need to think about these four things every time you start cooking, that's all you really need to do. And if I could make that the E equals MC squared, well, that's a big compliment. Now I'm Einstein and Julia Child. Yeah.
Again, where do we go from there? I haven't told anybody in this room yet, but I've come up with my own theory.
Oh, do tell.
And I'm shopping a cookbook. It's called Sugar, Fat, Sugar, Ice Cream.
Oh, I love it.
My theory. Yeah.
That's my actual theory. That's what I live by. Yeah.
My book's going to be 400. It's similar to yours, kind of. No pictures. Mm-hmm. 470 pages.
Seems good. Maybe chocolate. Sugar, fat, sugar.
Don't steal my idea.
White chocolate. White chocolate. That's the follow-up book to the Sugar, Fat, Sugar, Ice Cream. All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to find out how the hell, just technically, you did this book, how you keep your sanity, and what makes you tick. Just those. Just a few little things. We'll be right back.
Le Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle d'Estelle. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine, and from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've dreamt of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to quit that boring corporate job and check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world. Or add a short workshop or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu for course descriptions, dates, and online registration. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu.
Hey there, Bomb Squad. This is Donnie Yen from Team Cherry Bomb. My dog Teddy is a regular at Cherry Bomb HQ, and I care about where his food comes from, just as I do my own. That's why Teddy and I are excited about Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Castor and Pollock's new line of pet food is made from real ingredients, like grass-fed beef and wild-caught salmon. I love that they care about Teddy as much as I do. And as for Teddy, he gives it two paws up.
We are back with Samin Nosrat, the author of the bestseller Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. And as we said, we want to know technically how the heck you did this book. You wrote a proposal, I guess, like everybody has to, almost.
So
you told them there will be no photos.
Yeah. Man, I'm a crazy person. I think that's clear by now, right? So it was really Michael Pollan who encouraged me to pursue this particular book. And because I was teaching him how to cook and I had to explain this theory to him, and he was like, this is it. This is the book. Because I was always bringing him other ideas and they were bad. They were really bad. So every time he decided to kind of look... Yeah.
So did you know you had a book in you?
I've always wanted to write. Okay. I've always wanted to write a book. And in 2009, I stopped working in restaurants. And so around that time, I really committed more of my time to writing. That was like around that time I had my first couple of newspaper pieces. I was writing for the Edibles. I knew it was what I wanted. And by Edibles, I mean Edible San Francisco, not the other kind of Edibles. I don't know if you can write for those.
You write about them.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think I knew I had a book in me. I don't know that I knew what it was, even though this always was there. I don't know. This was just, it wasn't, I think I always was intimidated. I knew secretly in my belly that this would take a really long time. And Michael told me that this was what I had to do. And my stomach fell because I knew it was a big thing. And also because I knew it couldn't be photographed. And I love beautiful food photography so much. All I wanted was a beautiful book. And I couldn't figure out in that first moment how I could have a beautiful book without photos. I just was like, wait, is this going to be a textbook? You know? But pretty quickly I realized the answer was Wendy McNaughton. She's the answer to most problems. Yeah.
And
Wendy McNaughton is a fantastic, amazing human and brilliant illustrator, visual storyteller. Sometimes she calls herself a visual philosopher. She has a background in social work. She has a background in advertising and in copywriting. And she also went to art school. And so she has sort of this varied, layered background that manifests itself in a completely different kind of illustrative storytelling than I had ever seen before. And at that time, she had basically just left her. She was just starting out as a full-time illustrator, and she had a column on the Rumpus website. And it was really, she was just posting, I don't know, funny things. And she posted a lot of Venn diagrams that were very philosophical and flow charts that were really funny. And so I just knew she was funny, and I like to think that I'm kind of funny. And so there was a way where that funniness and the whimsy and the looseness of her drawing and the way it could tell stories, I just felt like that could be really useful in doing what I needed to do in this book, because I knew that it had the potential to be too overwhelming and too much information and too intimidating for people, especially if you don't think you know how to do anything. So I stalked her. Like, I've stalked many people in my life, and the three big stalking, like, and letters of admiration were the Chez Panisse letter. I stalked Michael Pollan. That one got me a good friendship and relationship. And then I wrote Wendy this crazy letter, and it said, the subject of the emails was, "You might think I'm stalking you."
That's a great way to start an email.
Yeah. And then it was like, "And you'd be right." And then I said, "You know, you're my generation's Myra Coleman. I love your work so much, and I can just see how we could make this thing, and I want to make a book, and it's a totally different kind of cookbook. And I want to tell stories." And we had a lot of friends in common. I'd never met her, but I knew we knew a lot of people in common. So I drew a Venn diagram showing how we had all these things in common. And I think it worked. And so pretty immediately she agreed to do it. And so we, and I also knew enough about publishing to know that publishers really like to go by what has been a proven success. They don't like to stray from the formulas that they know work. And this was going to stray in pretty much every way. So if I was going to convince anyone to let me do it my way, I had to make the proposal, make them feel like how I wanted the final book make them feel. And so that meant illustrating the proposal. So it took us maybe 6 months to work on it and illustrate it and tell the stories we wanted to tell and refine it. And we had a friend who's a book designer, a really brilliant woman, Sarah Edelman, designed it for us. And it felt like a mini book. It felt like our book. And so, and we sent it out and it was really well received. And my agent, a brilliant woman. She told me to get on a plane and be out here in New York City on Monday morning. And I came and we had like three bananas days of like meeting after meeting after meeting, and everyone wanted and they were drooling. And it was this big auction and we sold the book and it was very overwhelming and exciting. And then I went home and I was like, now what do we do?
So some nitty gritty questions, yeah. Because we have a lot of writers who listen and yeah. A lot of people who write cookbooks or want to write cookbooks. Was your advance enough to live on while you wrote this?
Yes. Should I be the crazy person who tells the number?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, oh my God, am I going to get in trouble? I wish my agent was here to tell me if I should do this.
You can give a ballpark.
I'll give a ballpark. It was a big number.
seven digits?
It was not seven digits.
Okay. Close? Six?
It was a hefty six digit number.
Okay. Great. Yeah. But that's remarkable. So
it is remarkable.
And it was enough money for you to live on to write the book.
Yeah.
And to write the book you wanted to write.
Yes. It was enough to, well, also, yeah, it was enough for me to live on, especially if I had stuck to the schedule that they had given me. And I also hadn't maybe bought myself a $5,000 bed right when I got my new bed and bed frame and stuff. And so
baby's got to sleep.
Yeah.
What was the timeline they gave you?
But so, you know, I think it was pretty typical book timeline of a year. You have a year to turn in your manuscript and then the book would come out the next year. So 2 years from when we signed was when it was supposed to come out. But I did not meet that. I didn't even remotely meet that. We sold it in 2013 and it came out in 2017. So,
right. Cause I met you
2013,
you know, in New Orleans. Was it New Orleans?
Oxford, Mississippi.
It was in Oxford and you handed me a card and it said salt, fat, acid, heat. And you're like, I'm working on this cookbook. And I was like, okay, great. Who's not?
Yeah, totally.
Working on a cookbook. I mean, no, I'm sure I wasn't alone. Nobody had any idea this was just going to land. And a lot of cookbooks land with a thud.
Yeah.
And your cookbook landed with just like fireworks. And
I have a question.
Yeah.
Actually, I was just curious what the workflow was with Wendy. With writing this book.
So we had no idea what we were doing. There were a lot of different parts of it. So what we first started out, we were on a high. A big high. Because also, like, I split that money in some proportion with Wendy. Mm-hmm. And so we were both really stoked. It was amazing. And to me, even before, I always was like, you can have as much money as you want. I just want you to feel, I want to know that you're in this with me. Not only now, but also when it's time to promote this book. Because I'll give you, and that's the way I feel about all collaboration is like, I don't care about stuff. I've never had any money. So what's the difference now? You know, I just want to make something and I want to know that you're going to be okay when I ask you to change that thing 10,000 times to get it just right. And that's exactly how it ended up being. And so we were so excited. And we had no idea what to do. I had worked on photo shoots for magazines before. So I had some idea of like how to make, I don't know, get food portrayed, but I had no idea, how to do it with an illustrator. And I had never worked with an illustrator. I'd never really seen Wendy work before. And she has a very particular process where she draws from life. So I needed to be there cooking and making the thing and explaining it to her and showing her so that she could draw. She draws very quickly. And then we would take pictures and then she would use those pictures for color reference. So she'd have to go back to her studio and then paint everything later. So, but what Wendy had maybe neglected to tell me and or I had neglected to hear was that she didn't ever cook or know anything about cooking. And so when I showed up at her house the first time, she has a really beautiful house that she shares with her partner, really beautiful kitchen. And it's like really clean and and it's clean because it's never used. And so I remember we went to the farmer's market together and we got all these beautiful things, my favorite beans and all this stuff. And we came back and I'd forgotten to get olive oil. So I opened her cupboards to look for olive oil. And there was just like 40 cases of Balance bars and there was no olive oil, you know, like they only ate Balance bars and whole food salad bar. That was it.
Were you like, oh my God, yeah. What have I gotten myself into?
Yeah. I mean, it was great. It ended up being a great tool because if I couldn't explain something to Wendy, then clearly I wasn't doing my job. I mean, I'm standing there right in front of her. And if I can't make it clear to her, then how am I going to make it clear to someone on the page? So she was a great guinea pig in a lot of ways. But that's what we did. And we would spend these whole days cooking and she would draw. And then we would have all this food. So we would invite our friends over and they would give us feedback. It was this great kind of beautiful thing. And that was the fun part. That was the really fun part. And we were like, this is going to be amazing. This book is going to be done in 20 dinner parties. Nope. You know, because then there was a lot of the philosophical stuff and the like science stuff that we had to figure out. There was so much back and forth. So we used a lot of Dropbox, a lot of texting, a lot of emails, a lot of me coming to her, her coming to me. And then there were also a lot of fallow periods where I had to go away and write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. There were things that I knew I wanted. Like I knew I wanted beautiful drawings of citrus at the height of its season in all of the different colors. I knew I wanted, And I started looking at that cooking, at food and ingredients through an artist's lens, which was really beautiful and fun. And I have to say the thing from Chez Panisse that I am the most grateful for is not really the cooking education. It's the aesthetic and sensual education. And so I learned how to see the world in that place because it prioritizes beauty and it prioritizes the senses. And out there is a full-time florist on staff, which is insane. There are the most beautiful flower arrangements. There are beautiful displays of incredibly rare and special produce. People treat the raw ingredients like gold. And I learned to care about things and value them in that way. And so meeting Wendy and working with Wendy gave me a whole new level of that, where I already loved, you know, Treviso and Radicchio and Castelfranco. And then when I was with Wendy, I started to see this is watercolor. This is nature's watercolor, or the way a dragon's tongue cranberry bean pod looks like it's watercolored. You know, there were these things that I was like, I want you to draw. And she, you know, and we'd both get really excited, or there were things I grew really excited to show her because I knew she'd never seen a Kyoja beet before when you cut into it and it's like a candy cane inside. And so it just became this amazing thing where we were going back and forth and she started cooking. I gave her a cast iron pan. I gave her a bean pot. She started making herself a pot of beans every week. She would make herself frittatas and polenta, and like, it just felt amazing to see her do it because they really were eat to livers, not live to eaters. And now they're live to eaters. So the
balance bars are gone.
Yeah. There's still balance bars. Yeah. Just not as many.
So you mentioned that the publishing company was a little anxious about the title.
Mm-hmm.
At what stage did they try to get you to change it? Were they relaxed through the process? I mean, they give you a big check.
It was a difficult and long process. I think every book, making any book, is probably a difficult and long process. And also, I'm a crazy person, and I sold the book to an editor who I really had an amazing connection with, and I felt like we were literary unicorn brother and sisters. And his name is Mike Zaraban, and he's an amazing editor. And he got a job a year after I signed with him, and he left. And
I was afraid you were going to say that.
And so, and I really, you know, like I had never made something this big before. I put a lot of my power in his hands. And when he was leaving, he told me, he was like, I'm not the one doing this. Like, you're doing this, and the magic is in you. You can do this. you don't need me, you know, you don't need any editor. You can do this. And so
he was like your Obi-Wan Kenobi.
He was my Obi-Wan. Yeah. And he left. Yeah. And he left. And I got passed into other very capable hands for sure. But it was not, I just never felt like he got it. The letter that he wrote me when he bought the book, he got it in his bones. And, I didn't necessarily always feel that everyone else got it because he was the rare sort of, he was coming from like a non-traditional, he got it because he knew cookbooks and he knew food. And, I'm, you know, Simon & Schuster, man, they've been so supportive. They're so awesome, but they're not a traditional cookbook house. And I chose them because they weren't a traditional cookbook house because I didn't want to be treated like a traditional cookbook.
Right. But and sometimes that's bad. Yeah. We have friends who that's backfired.
Yeah. On. And I think when I got handed into other hands of people who were less familiar with how cookbooks are made, it was more challenging. And so a lot more things sort of like a lot of places have a house style for their cookbooks. And I was like begging them to give me a house style because I was like, give me something. Like I need something to stray from at least, you know, give me some rules so I can break them. And there was no thing. So I had to really build that from scratch, which was really, it was really hard. Ultimately it worked out fine. But
we had two rules that one we broke, one we failed in getting permission to break. The one we failed to get permission to break was water as an ingredient.
Oh, right. Yes.
So we weren't allowed to list water in the list of ingredients.
Oh, right.
Which made me crazy. Water's an ingredient.
Totally.
If it's 8 cups, I want to know it.
Totally.
Because a lot of times I'll use my Brita to measure out the water. Uh-huh. And then if it's not in the list of ingredients, you sometimes forget it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's nice. And yeah. And what was the other one?
The other one was for serving size, they like to list the number of people it serves.
Oh, right. And rather than how many servings
right.
it makes.
And I feel like, you know, I'm frequently single. Lots of us are frequently right. single. I don't want to, if it says serves 4 people, I'm like, well, that sucks. Thanks for reminding me. It's me at home cooking for myself.
You wanted to say makes 4 cups or something.
Right, because yeah. I might want to make it for myself. Maybe I am having friends over, or maybe I want to make it for myself and then have it for lunch all week. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
Don't rub in my face how many people.
Yeah, we
won that one.
Yeah, that's good.
Yes.
That's good.
Yes, but that yeah. was it.
And so, I don't know, it was a new path for all of us, which in a lot of ways was amazing. And I have to say, like, the editor who I ended up working with is so detail oriented. And as crazy and obsessive as I am, I sometimes miss a lot of details. So her obsession and her obsessiveness with organizing things from biggest to smallest, with organizing things in alphabetical order, with being like so careful about the way I repeat things, that only made it stronger and it only made it better. And so there were ways where, you know, like we all sort of make our way through and we do what we do. It just took a really long time yeah. and it was really, really hard. And I felt like I had a lot of standing my ground to do and feeling like and I have always been this person who knows what I want to do or what I want to make. And I feel like that's a really important thing and that's what I say in the cooking too, is like be able to visualize the end product so you can move toward that. And so for me in this book, I didn't always know what it would look like or what it would say, but I always knew what I wanted it to do and how I wanted it to function and how I wanted it to make the reader feel. And those were not necessarily things that traditional books from a traditional publisher do.
I can't even imagine the copy editing process.
Yeah, it was epic.
Or the proofreading process.
There were so many levels of it. And it's, you know, the amazing thing that ended up being so helpful was that the book also sold to a separate publisher in England. And so I had a separate editor there and a separate copy editor and a separate whole system there. So I had sort of a backup level of safety net. And Wendy and I got to work with the designer of our choosing, who his name is Alvaro Villanueva. He is a brilliant book editor, a brilliant book designer. And he came from publishing. He was an editor for a long time. So he just had his own. There were so many people who had so many skill sets working on this. And everybody was just giving their all, putting it in. So it really was in many, many people's hands, which only helped, I think, ultimately.
Okay, we only have a few minutes.
Can we go back to the magic of Samin for a second?
Yes.
Okay. Quick question. everything about this book is so you. Like, when we left last night, I was walking home with the book, and it started raining, and, like, put it under my jacket, and I felt like I was, like, taking you home. You know, like, we were going, and I stopped along the way and got a martini at a travel bar near Carrie's apartment. And maybe this sounds a little spiritual, but Carrie, while you're gone, I got my cards in, and they told me I'm a witch, actually. But how do you put so much of yourself in this book? And what does it feel like now that it is here? Like, what is there, like, emptiness? And, like, you have so much going on, but, like, it's out. Like, what is that?
I think in that way it's a lot like what people say it's like having a child. Like, I'm so glad it's out. I'm so glad it's out of me. It was really... But I was conscious the whole time of putting as much of myself in it as I possibly could. In that way, you know, a book that I thought of a lot was Tamara Adler's book, An Everlasting Meal. And I had a lot of friends who read that, and there were a lot of people I saw on the internet who read that and would say, Tamar says this, or like, Tamar would do this. And Tamar is always in my head whenever I'm doing something where I'm like, oh, Tamar would totally do this. And so I loved that idea of having like a little Tamar on my shoulder, and I really wanted to be the little Samin on your shoulder. So that was something I was always thinking of, was like, how do I make this as silly and me and my voice as possible? And I mean, and Wendy was really committed to that, and my editor and everyone was really committed to that too. But it was not easy. Like, at many times I got really depressed during the making of it. I got super sick. I had like a mystery ailment that took many doctors and endocrinologists to figure out what it was. And I think ultimately it was just probably stress. It was a long, hard process.
So when you said you had seen therapists during it, you weren't kidding.
I have, like, the therapist saved me, antidepressants saved me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was hard. It was not easy. But I also knew, you know, I think I said this in the beginning when I mentioned my therapist, that it was really important for me to come up with a definition of success that wasn't measured by outside means. And for me, that what I came up with was I want to be able to look at this thing at the end of it and feel like I did everything I could do to make it as good as it could possibly be. And that is what I would consider a success. And I really do. Like, there's mistakes in it. I feel, you know, there are things maybe I wish I had now, as small things that I could have changed or whatever, but I know I gave it my all, and like, I feel that. So I don't feel empty at all. Like, it was a creative thing, and it's done, and I'm thankful. I'm so thankful it's done, and I get to go do the next thing. Yeah.
It's funny. I had a similar question just about how you're taking care of yourself now, because it did turn out to be a huge success. So that must be a huge burden lifted off your shoulders. But now everyone wants your time. Everyone's asking you for things. How are you not losing your mind and taking care of yourself?
I haven't figured that out that well. It's been very extreme. So I like have been spending so much time on the road, so much time out in the world, and I'll go home and I'm like crap. So there's like these epic extremes, like all or nothing. And I would like to try to get to something a little bit more moderate. I am nervous about that though, because I'm now about to start shooting this show, and that involves so much traveling and so much of me. I think in some ways, when we did the screen test, it was really fun. Like, I have a lot of fun doing it, and I think I'm pretty good at it. And I have a lot to learn. And I think what I learned for sure just during that week-long screen test was how you have to ramp yourself. I have to like ramp it up to 11, and I have to be my most me self, almost to like a caricature version of myself, for that to come through on the screen. And that takes a lot of energy, and you have to tune everything out, and you have to believe all of the people who are standing on the set telling you, you're looking great, you're doing great, because that's the only thing that will like give you the juice to keep doing the thing you're doing. And then I started to think, I was like, well, this is a slippery slope to like believe what they're saying it to you to get the work done, and then to like continue to believe that after the cameras are off and after you leave. Like, I was like, oh, I get where the crazy narcissism can come from. But, I don't know. What am I doing? I go swimming. I'm going to physical therapy for my knee. I eat a lot of quinoa. I drink water. I have been sleeping really well. I'm going to try and take a vacation.
You probably can't cook as much. Is that frustrating?
No, it's fine. I'm fine. I'm not really super duper into eating like big restaurant meals, but I'm fine with just eating a quesadilla. Yeah.
Good to know. Yeah. That's it for today's show. Thank you to Dave Tadashore for engineering. Thank you to Le Cordon Bleu for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. Don't forget to enter our Le Cordon Bleu sweepstakes going on right now, ending soon. To enter, visit cherrybomb.com and click on the banner. You could win a trip to Paris, London, or Ottawa, plus culinary classes and spending money. Thank you to Castor and Pollux for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. If you are a devoted pet parent, be sure to check out Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients from Castor and Pollux. Make sure you pick up the latest issue of Cherry Bomb. It is a great beach read, and Samin is in it. We've got a wonderful story written by Priya Krishna. And you can find the issue at most Barnes & Nobles and places like Omnivore Books on Food in Samin's backyard in San Francisco. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.